Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Today we have a very special guest. We're speaking to none other than Andrew Griffiths, our good old mate, AG, all the way from Cairns, who happens to be Australia's leading small business author. How are you, mate?
Very good, thank you. Jesse, how are you?
Yeah, mate, fabulous. We're sweltering down here in Canberra, mate. We have a balmy 38 degrees. I think we're giving you guys in North Queensland a bit of a run for your money today.
Unbelievable. Geez, you'd feel it down there at 38 degrees, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, it's been uncommon for us, mate. It's normally minus six, so yeah, it's a bit of a shock for the system. So, mate, we're having a great chat today, mate. We're having a chat about all things related to success.
And a great topic.
Yeah, So I'm really looking forward to diving into that. But before we do that, mate, I wanted to give some people who may not be as familiar with your work as the people who belong to the Practice Max community, because they all know you and love you. But for the general audience, what you might not know about Andrew, he's a contributor to the Inc. magazine, Flying Solo, CBS, and you're a mentor at KPI, the Key Person of Influence program. Mate, that's a CV and a half. How did you get into all that?
And I guess it's like all CVs, you know, I mean, it tells kind of half the story. I think I've had a few different lives, Jess. That's the reality of it. I think I started, I'm a commercial diver by trade. So for me, I had a business. I bought my first business when I was 18, and I bought a dive shop in Sydney, of all places. And just as life evolved, I did different things. I worked in exploration in Western Australia for a few years. I've worked in travel. I've traveled around the place. But it really, what I'm doing now really started, I think, I got decompression sickness as a commercial diver. Wow. and I had to retrain myself. And the company I was working for, they retrained me, put me into sales and marketing. And I kind of took to it like a duck to water. And then next thing I thought, well, I'll start my own marketing business. And the real change for me came when I actually wrote a book about marketing. So I wrote a really simple book, 101 Ways to Market Your Business. And from that, great things fortunately evolved. That's probably the easiest way to describe it, Jess.
Yeah, okay, wow. And you've got 12 books now, Andrew?
Mm-hmm. Yep, 12 books in some 60 countries around the world. So they're sold in around 60 countries, at times more, times less. They've been translated into Indian, into Vietnamese, Chinese, Indonesian, Thai, Estonian, of all, wow. Of all beliefs. It's very, very cool if you're traveling around to see your books in different languages. And of course, I've got a whole pile of the foreign language editions here as well, which is, it's really cool. But also to me, interesting enough, Jess, it really highlights that I talk about pretty simple stuff. I talk about the challenges of doing business and how to do business better. And, you know, that's what I'm really passionate about, helping people to achieve greater results in whatever they're doing. And it's kind of interesting to see that my books have been so successful in different areas, which just kind of showcases and highlights the fact that, you know, people have the same issues, the same problems all around the world. It doesn't matter where you are. You know, businesses in Vietnam have the same challenges as the businesses in Australia. They might look a little bit different, but at the end of the day, they're pretty much similar. And I think that's probably one of the biggest realizations for me with the success that I've had in the literary world.
And that's a really interesting point, mate, because one of the things that I know you and I have spoken about in other conversations is about, you know, the similarities from one business to another. What can we learn from one business and what can we, you know, what can be applied from someone else's business that we can take into our own? And as we, you know, dive into this topic of success and peak performance, I know that there's going to be a lot of dental practice owners and just, you know, dentists themselves thinking, you know, I just want to be a dentist. You know, why do I need to think about all this sort of stuff? I'm just wondering if you've come across that kind of situation with other professions and what would be your thoughts around that, mate?
And it's a great point, and I'm sure you're right. There are always people listening going a little bit overwhelmed when you start mentioning words like success. That can be a challenging word for a lot of people, which is interesting. But when you start to throw in the concept of peak performance, that can, you know, again, scare people off and saying, hey, look, I just want to have a business where I can make a good living, feed the family, have a nice holiday every year and do those kind of, have a life that I'm happy with and satisfied with. Well, to me, to achieve that, you have to be successful and you have to be a peak performer. It's just that there's different degrees of peak performance. Now, it doesn't mean you've got to climb Mount Everest once a week. It just still means, though, that if you want to be successful, and personally, I've yet to meet anyone who I would deem successful who isn't a peak performer. It's just that they don't consider themselves a peak performer. That's the reality of it for me. I would never have called myself a peak performer, but other people keep telling me that I am, and I kind of go, oh, well, I must be. But it certainly isn't a term that I would have applied to myself, Jess. And I guess that maybe other people are the same.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point. So I guess, you know, what I'm hearing you say is success, in inverted commas, means so many different things to different people, and one person's definition is their own, and that's completely cool.
Absolutely. And I think that to me is vital. If I'm working with someone, if I'm coaching someone, or if I'm, you know, whatever situation it might be, and I really ask them to define what success really looks like for them. You know, and what does it really mean? Not the kind of flippant driving a Maserati, got a mansion by the beach, got babes hanging off me, or any of that kind of stuff. But what does it really, really mean? And when people are honest with themselves and they start to give more meaningful answers to that, it's a lot more about contribution. It's about security. It's about freedom to be able to do the things that they want to do. It's very few people say, oh, I want to be successful so I can do nothing. You know, I want to be really successful so I can sit on the beach from when I'm 40 to when I'm 90. I don't see successful people saying that. In fact, they say the opposite. You know, they say, well, you know, I want to have the financial freedom to do more stuff. I want to give back. I want to contribute. I want to change the world in some shape or form, or my little world in some shape or form, you know, provide a future for my children. And I think defining what success means to you in a really honest way in your relationships, in your health and well-being, in your business, in your interactions with others, in your relationship with the world, you know, that to me is what it's all about. And if you have a good definition of that and a clarity around that, then you'll tend to make it happen. And if you don't want to use the term peak performance, you use another term, you know. But the reality of it is that you don't have to think about athletes climbing Mount Everest. You just go say, well, that's the things I want, that's my definition of success, now I'm going to go out and make it happen. And that is what they'll do.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of that too, mate, is because in the past when I've been thinking about my own goals, and, you know, when I was in my 20s particularly, I used to have these visions of successful people and thinking I needed to emulate, you know, what they were doing. And to be truthful, I found that a bit intimidating. And I felt it was actually a negative motivator rather than a positive motivator in some senses, because I just thought, oh, that was just so far out of my zone. You know, don't bother. So what I love about that is if you can, you know, take success in your own way, in your own definition, and think consciously about that, then that's cool. Mate, I just wanted to tap into something you said there about contribution and relationships and all that other sort of stuff. It's the new year, it's early 2016, and traditionally at this time of year we think about goals. Do you think that, you know, setting goals and you know, thinking consciously about those things, I'm guessing I know the answer, but, you know, how do you translate those big picture ideas into something concrete and that you can work towards? Do you go through a goal setting process yourself?
I do it a little bit differently though these days. I used to be a bit of the, you know, here are my top 10 goals for the coming year, and this is what they're going to look like, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to get that done by January, that done by February.
Yeah.
For me now, goals are much broader, I think is probably the easiest way to say it. Like, part of my planning process is to say, I spend a lot of time reviewing the year that was, and it's really important for me to kind of figure out, what am I really proud of that I didn't the last year, you know, what frustrated me, what irritated me, what didn't I do, you know, why didn't I do it? And I like to do that really reflection of the good and the bad from the year that was. And then that forms the basis of my planning for the year that is. And I look at that and go, well, okay, what am I going to do more of in the coming year? And what am I going to do less of in the coming year? So that for me, you know, is starting to set that kind of mood where you're looking at, so my own behavior perhaps is where I start.
Yeah.
And then I'll turn around and, like, you know, some of my, you know, more of, less of in the coming year is, I've got them in a notebook in front of me. One of them is one thing. I'm going to focus more on one thing at a time. Last year, I got pulled apart in a lot of different directions, and I'm a big believer in that, focusing on one thing. So that's going to be one of my things that I'm focusing on, is every day, what's the one thing that I need to get done today, the most important thing right here, right now. I'm going to eat more good food, eat less stuff that's not good for my body. I'm going to do more yoga. I'm going to do less sitting. I'm going to make more money, have less wasted money. I'm going to listen more and talk less. You know, they're the kind of, you know, they're not, I wouldn't call those goals, but I'd call those behavioral goals that I look at for me. But on top of that, then, sure, then I'd have my business goals, and they are, I'm going to, you know, run 6 programs on there. I'm going to have, you know, 10 coaching clients. I'm going to do 30 keynote speaking jobs, you know, whatever it might be in my little world, and a targeted amount of revenue that I'm going to make in 2016. And I know that I'm going to do that. And then I have one for my writing as well. What do I want to do with my writing? You know, I'm going to develop my writing style, et cetera, et cetera. So I have... Rather than just a list of these are my 10 goals for the year, I've over many years have worked out a system that I think just works a little bit better for me, and is much more about less perhaps definitives and more behavioral type stuff, but there are still definitely some very specific goals in there to achieve as well.
That's really interesting that you say, mate. I love the way that you've framed that. And, you know, what I really love about what you do is, you know, we see this in action all the time. And, you know, those of us who are fortunate enough to get to hang out with you a bit more, you know, we see these come through and see you live them. One of the things I've learned from you, actually, Andrew, as we've been talking, I don't know, whenever we spoke throughout 2015, was setting themes as well. So just to share with you, one of my big themes, where there's some similarities here with you, is to simplify as much as I can. I've found that my life got a little bit complicated in some areas, and I was adding more and more stuff into it, and I've just found that I need to strip some stuff away and get back to the essence of the good stuff.
And themes are great because they become – so if I go back a step, Jess, with the stuff that I talk about, so I have the overarching themes for the year. Then I come down and say, well, what is that going to look like? You know, so I want to move more. Okay, physically, I want to move more. So then I break that down. I'm going to do more yoga. I'm going to, you know, stand more, use my stand-up desk more. I'm going to go for walks more. I'm going to, you know, have more adventure holidays as opposed to laying by the pool holidays, or whatever it might be. And then you tear that down to the third stage, and that's actually turning those into specific goals. Right, book 3 holidays now, and they're going to be, you know, walking holidays.
Yeah.
You know, right, you know, buy the extra gear you need for your stand-up desk or whatever it is today, and stand up for 20 minutes a day. You know, or when I'm at home working or writing or whatever. And then, you know, each week stand up for another 20 minutes, you know, and increase it over the space of the year. And so starting with a big picture, strangely enough, a lot of people don't do that. And I think that the theme for the year is just a great way to actually to give a meaning and to, I guess, give that drive, that kind of point to aim for, that this time next year you want to go, well, you know what, I achieved that during the year. I did, you know, do less. I did simplify my life, and I got better stuff done. And, you know, and it's like saying no. If your big theme is, like, this year I'm going to say no a lot more, you know, because I'm getting pulled apart in too many different directions, then again, you know, like, that's something that you need to focus on all the time. And I've had a few of those years where I've really had to say, look, I've got to say no more. And so you automatically say no before you say yes.
Yes.
And people go, oh, but you're going to miss opportunities, et cetera. But the problem is, well, I wasn't really taking advantages of the opportunities that I had because I was too busy, you know, chasing butterflies.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good thing to do. And I think you can change a theme during the year as well. I think you can master it. You go, you know what? I've got on top of this now. I've simplified. I can actually have another theme now. I don't have to have 12 months of simplifying if I've got my life simplified and I feel on track after 3.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a really nice thing as well. But if you start to sneak back into a bad habit, then you've got to kind of get the theme up again. That's the way that I look at it.
Yeah, look, that's certainly the way I've come to look at things too. And that's really been based on quite a few conversations that we'd had over a number of months. Mate, I wanted to touch base because you're in an entrepreneurial space where you come across heaps and heaps and heaps of people. And what I love about what you do, Andrew, is you have a reputation for being probably one of the most generous people in the business space. And I think that's, you know, firstly, huge kudos to you, which is wonderful. But what I wanted to ask you is, you know, as you observe, you know, this plethora of people, What do you think that it is that the successful people do differently in terms of habits or mindset, or what is you think that actually allows them to achieve their own success perhaps more than others would?
It's a good question, isn't it? You know, I think there's a few things, to be honest, Jess. I look at that and I think that successful people that I know, I think that they're great dreamers.
Yeah.
You know, they are able to dream and create a vision and have a plan. Yeah, sometimes the implementation and sometimes the actual doing is not that good, but they have a dream, you know, about, I want to do this. You know, I know for me, when I wanted to be a writer, I just had such a dream of making it happen that really nothing was going to get in the way. And of course, you make it happen. So I think of all the successful people I know, they are very good at dreaming and kind of visualizing that what that dream is going to look like. And that's what makes it happen. We know that. The second thing I think that they're very good at is they have a high level of self-belief. And, you know, it was interesting for me, Jess. I tell this story often, but when I was thinking about writing my first book about marketing, and I asked a number of people in the marketing world that I knew of, like, what do you reckon? I've kind of got an idea for a book on 101 ways to market your business. And you know what? Most of them turned around and said to me, Andrew, you know, you're a nice bloke, but really? Kind of, you haven't got any qualifications. You know, you live in Cairns, for starters. You're not famous. Like, who's going to publish anything that you've written? And, you know, really, what do you know? And of course, I was quite surprised by that, but I completely ignored them and wrote it anyway. And how lucky am I that I did? And I look at that and I think successful people have high self-belief in themselves. Now, it doesn't mean they don't go through their stages of doubt, imposter syndrome, all of the rest of it, which we all do. Believe me, I do as well. But they have enough, they have more self-belief than they have self-doubt. And I think when you have more self-belief than self-doubt, well, that's when you make stuff happen. The third thing I think that they tend to do well is they're very good learners. You know, that they learn and they listen. You know, they observe, they're hungry. You know, I worked with a guy for a number of years, a Swiss guy who was an amazing entrepreneur. And we were traveling around the world. I was working for a company. He had his own resort and he was in his 70s and I was in my 30s, you know. So, and he could outrun me. And what I admired about him, everyone he met, he would ask questions about how can I do business better? How could I do this better? How could I, you know, do that? Keen to learn. When I had the pleasure of working with Richard Branson, you know, and met him in Melbourne, you know, the questions that he asked me were, you know, tell me about your business. How do you do what you do? How have you been successful as an author? You know, where are your books published? How did you do it? How did you come up with the ideas? Successful people ask a lot of questions and they listen to the answers. I think that that's a real sign of a successful person. Anyone who gets up and says, hey, I've got all the answers, we already know that, you know, it's kind of, they're probably a douche, you know, so we kind of, we don't go. But the more successful they are, the more they tend to ask and the more they tend to listen. I definitely think that. And probably a last one or two there, I would say, Jess, is one is they normally have a really good peer group. So that they have good people around them, which I think is important. And I think we all know the value of a peer group. And then probably last but not least, or maybe second last, would be that they're very resilient. They get knocked down, they dust themselves off, and they get back up. And even if the idea they did or they had failed, they, you know, that they don't kind of go off and suck their thumb and sulk about it for the next 10 years. They just move on to the next thing. And the last point I'm going to say in here is I think that they are generous.
Yeah.
Generous with their time, generous with their spirit, generous with their knowledge, and keen to help other people. And that's, they're all the signs to me of what really successful people actually do.
Mate, that is quite a list. And firstly, there's so many questions that are coming up for me now. I just wanted to ask you, but I guess the big question I wanted to ask you with those particular attributes is, do you think people are necessarily born with those, or do you think they can be cultivated, or do you think they learn them, or is it about surrounding yourself with the right people and, you know, getting some of that through osmosis? What's your thoughts around some of that? Because people it's might be sitting there going, I'm just not in that space right now. How do I get self-belief?
You know? Yeah, sure. It's definitely about the right peer group. There's no doubt about it. I think that, you know, some people are born with a vision. You know, like I remember seeing a guy on TV who runs a really successful restaurant in the Hudson River off New York. And that was interesting. You know, he was being interviewed and they said, so when did you want to be a chef and run a restaurant? He said, my earliest thought. And they said, "What? How old?" I said, 5 or 6 years old. He said, "I wanted a restaurant, you know, 7 years." And you know, he's 50 or 60 now. And they said, "Well, what are you going to do in 10 years?" I said, "I'm still running my restaurant." And it was so passionate and, you know, just that conviction was there. And some people are lucky, you know, they have that conviction at an early age. Most of us aren't. I wanted to be a marine biologist at a young age. Then I kind of realized, well, you know, I'll spend more time in a lab doing stuff I don't want to do than riding, you know, humpback whales around the ocean, which I imagine a marine biologist would do. But I do think that we change, we evolve, we grow, and we hopefully, you know, we learn along the way. I do think you can learn about these things. I think that more and more people discover it in themselves that, hey, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur and I can do that. Other times we find people that, hey, I'm an entrepreneur or I run a business and I really don't want to. I just want to work for someone and get a pay packet. And that's okay as well. So I guess it's a combination of learning. A lot of time it's failing. You know, like I know for me, a lot of my life, there were so many mistakes that I made in business and still make in business. You know, I think anyone who says they don't is probably just not trying hard enough. You know, some of the most successful people that I know of are making mistakes every day. But they don't kind of beat themselves up about it. They kind of go, awesome, you know, I'm one step closer to getting it right. And I think there's that real culture that we see in the entrepreneurial space and the success space of it comes back to that resilience factor again. Going, okay, well, this is what I want. I'm clear about what I want. I'll do what it takes to get it. And sometimes, you know, I'll make a mistake and I'll have to take a different path or a different direction or find a different peer group or learn a better way to do it or whatever the case may be. And that will help me get to where I want to go.
Mate, that's fantastic. So I guess what you're saying is that, you know, it's a constantly evolving thing. And yeah, as we go through life, yeah, as long as we're defining success on our own terms, you know, as you said, you know, you might find yourself in a business and then think, you know, maybe that's not for me. And that's fine. You go and work for someone else. And that's a perfectly great definition of a successful life. There's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. It comes back to that point. What does success mean to you?
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't define what that really is for you, then I think that you're looking for success on someone else's terms. What you've seen in a movie or what you have this false kind of vision around it is, you know, like you think all the money in the world will solve all your problems. And I know it's easy to think that way when you haven't got any money, but it's rarely the case. I do think as we grow, we get a little bit older, a little bit wiser, and that helps us to perhaps get a little bit clearer about what success means to us. Very different if you ask an 18-year-old kid what success means to them, you ask a 50-year-old woman what success means to them, two very, very different definitions.
Yeah, no, fabulous. That's really good. Mate, while we're talking about these things that, you know, I guess contribute to success, and you know, as I said, you've come across a lot of different people in your line of work. I don't know if I can ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there anyone that springs to mind that's, you know, really inspired you and you thought, wow, they've just been great? You know, someone you might have observed or worked with, or I guess to put it another way, who would you have at a dinner party if you could invite these people over?
Mm-hmm. I've been really lucky, and even like I kind of feel often like I'm just getting started with what I'm doing, and I have been fortunate enough to work with some pretty extraordinary people, but also I guess met some extraordinary people and followed a lot of extraordinary people in the same vein. Yep. As well, and so I kind of look at them in a couple of different directions there. I think, Jess, you know, I think about when I got into personal development at a young age. You know, I was given a copy of Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Mm-hmm. And when I was 18, I just bought my first business. And I've got to say, for me, even though I don't like the title of it, it's one of the most extraordinary books that I've ever read about how to deal with people. And it really, really tailored my entire life. And in fact, I just wrote an article for Inc.com about it, which was I read the same book every year. Christmas morning, it's my ritual. I spend a couple of hours and I read Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. So I've read it 30 times now. And and I look at that and go, it's just a wonderful kind of a book to learn stuff. So a lot of people like that were like that for me, like Zig Ziglar. You know, I've loved Zig Ziglar, and I had the fortune of talking to Zig Ziglar a few years before he died. You know, those kind of people who were inspirational and motivational and told wonderful stories. A little bit later on, then it's things like Tony Robbins, you know, is to me a very inspirational guy. And some people love him, some people hate him. I think he's awesome. I look at Louise Hay, you know, a lady who started a business in her 50s. and has built this incredible global publishing empire. And I just think she's one of the most extraordinary women on the face of the planet. You know, right through to, interesting enough, there's so many people. But then now for me, you know, having doing what I've been doing for quite a long time now, you know, I look back at the people that I've met who are entrepreneurs. You know, there's a guy that owns a chicken shop around the corner from where I live, you know, as in roast chickens.
Yep.
He's been running this business for 30 years.
Wow.
And I look at that, you know, making roasted chickens for 30 years. And I tell you, I've never seen him without a smile on his face. I've never seen him not engaging his customers. I've never seen him not giving his staff a bollocking because something's not good enough. You know, like I just look at that and think, what an amazing guy. And I met a lot of those people. I met recently a guy called Edwin. I can't remember his surname, but he was a third generation sausage and small goods maker in Brisbane. 85. Okay, so his grandfather had immigrated to Australia, set up the small good factory, and of course Edwin came into it when he was like 10, and now Edwin's just letting go of it now to give it to his grandson, and Edwin's going, oh, I don't know, you know, this like his wife saying he's got to have a holiday, and you look at this guy and you think, what is this guy? He was in the business for 70 years,
phenomenal,
so modest, so humble, and you know, if I look at a person like that, and I go, man, I just want to sit and I just want you to tell me everything. What have you know? And people go, well, what does he know about social media? He doesn't know anything about social media, but he knows about people. He knows about developing products. He knows about doing business. He knows about negotiating, about, excuse me, about money management, about getting through tough times. It's, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And I'm far more inspired by people that have gone through that than by someone who maybe has, you know, started one company that's been really successful and they sold it for $30 million. You go, that's awesome. I admire you for it. It's cool, great, and all the rest of it. But I'll be interested to see where you are in 10 years, 15 years, and see what you've done with yourself and with the company and with the money and all the rest of it. And so I guess more now as I get older, I'm looking towards those people who really inspire me are the unknown people.
Yeah.
That no one knows Edwin. No one knows, you know, the guy at the chicken shop around the corner from me. You know, no one really knows, you know, those people. They're not famous, but they're the ones that I think are just extraordinary at what they do.
Yeah, look, I agree wholeheartedly. I'm always drawn to those people who have lost a little bit of bark as well. You know, the people who have kind of, you know, had a few knocks along the way but managed to get up and continue to, you know, have another swing and you know, eventually had the success that they were looking for. You know, you mentioned the guy that, you know, he starts his company in his dorm room at Harvard and sells it at 21 for $1 squillion. And, yeah, which is, as you say, good luck to them. But the people who I really look to are the people who have overcome some sort of adversity to you know, climb whatever summit it is that's important for them. So that's really cool. Ladies and gents, if you're just joining us now, we are speaking to the one and only Andrew Griffiths, Australia's number one small business author, contributor to a bazillion magazines such as Inc., Flying Solo, CBS, a mentor at Key Person of Influence, the world's leading personal brand accelerator, all-around good guy. Andrew, just wanted to have a chat, if we could, about where you think that, you know, we're talking about, you know, these successful people and so on and so forth, but we've spoken about some of their attributes. But one of the things that has always interested me, and I'm going to butcher a quote in a minute, and I'm hoping you might be able to set me straight because the quote has just completely sprung to mind right now and I haven't written it down in preparation. But it's the old saying, you know, you sow an action, you reap a habit, and you sow a habit, you reap a destiny, and so on and so forth. I can't remember whose quote that is, and I know that I've completely butchered it. But I did want to talk to you a little bit about the role or the importance of habits in you know, people getting through to achieve what it is that's important to them. Do you have any thoughts around that at all?
I do, a lot, to be honest. I think, again, for me, I don't really call them habits. I call them rituals.
Yep.
And I guess whatever you call them, because I find that if I've got the right rituals, that I make things happen. And again, I do think that it's a very common characteristic of very successful people is that they've developed the right set of rituals or the right set of habits. You know, for me, I have certain rituals. Like I get up very early, so I'm at, you know, my desk by about 5 o'clock pretty much every morning. And you know, I spend that first hour getting my act together. So my first, you know, hour of just, I don't check my email. I don't do that first of all. I plan for the day. I really focus. What's that one thing that I need to be doing, you know, today? My main project that I want to get knocked over during the day. What am I focusing on? I read through my notebook with my visions for my business for the year. What am I doing? Making sure that I'm on track. I do a bit of writing as well. Normally I write an article every morning, so I'll do that in that hour as well. Then after that, then I'll go and I've kind of woken up then enough. Then I'll go and do other things like do a bit of yoga, maybe have a walk, have a nice breakfast, do that. And then I'll come in. And so by then it's normally around 7:30, 8 o'clock. Then I'll start and spend an hour doing my email. And one of the new things that I'm doing this year, like a lot of people, is a new ritual for me is to batch my email. Yeah. So I'm only going to check my email 3 times a day, and I'll check it first thing in the morning, 8 o'clock-ish. I'll check it again around 11, and then I'll check it again around 3 and do that. I've just, like, again, many of us, I think I've just got to break that habit of being stuck on email all day long. It's once you start doing email and you open your email, you spend the rest of the day responding to everyone else's demands. And I just think that to get anything done these days, we've just got to get much smarter at how we do that.
Yeah, look, I agree wholeheartedly. I think for me, the other one is alerts on phones is another one that takes me.
Turn them all off. Yeah, turn them all off.
Absolutely. If I see, you know, Facebook or whatever it is, you know, sending me an alert that so-and-so has commented on this or that, and the number of times I've been taken off task. So like you, I've actually, I've come on down to twice a day now. You know, so it's morning and night. And,
nice.
And I think it really just gives you that clarity of thought, and it gives you that uninterrupted time to focus on a particular task, because when you are completing a task, as soon as that, you know, concentration is interrupted, it takes, I don't know, for me it takes about 10 minutes to kind of get my head back into the zone of where I was before the interruption. I don't know if you find that.
A neuroscientist will tell you it's 20 minutes.
Really?
Well, there you go. Even if you think you're back in there, you're not.
Yeah.
You know, when you're multitasking and when you're just distracted, that's where it is. I know for me, Jess, if I spend a day writing, so my day is writing, book or whatever it might be.
Yep.
So I get up in the morning, I might check my email, but then the rest of the day I'm just going to be writing, or I might not check my email. I always find that at the end of the day, how I feel is very different. I feel clear, I feel calm, I feel like I've got a lot done, I feel a real sense of satisfaction, and I feel quite energized. Yeah, at the end of a day when I've been on email all day and social metering and taking 50 phone calls and doing all this kind of stuff, I feel absolutely exhausted by 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I notice, and not physically exhausted, but mentally exhausted, and rightly so. I think that the moral to the story there is, I think we've got to be constantly developing our work habits, our rituals, whatever it might be. No one taught us to use email. No one taught us to use social media. No one's taught us how to manage this stuff. And every time we turn around, there's more stuff for us to deal with. And I predict that 2016 is the year of the digital detox, you know, where more and more people are going to say, you know what, I'm just going to disconnect and I'm going to work in really powerful moments. I had a really interesting example of this, Jesse. I went on a retreat last year to a place called Camp Eden for, you know, where you go there, people go there to stop smoking and I don't know, whatever other things they want to stop. For me, it was really just, it was a week of a lot of travel beforehand. I was tired. I just wanted a really good, healthy week. No email, no internet, no at all. There's no signal in the valley, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. You can't sneak it in. And you started every day with yoga, and there's no tea and coffee and all that kind of jazz there. So anyway, what I really, really noticed was how difficult it was the first day, but then how, as the week progressed, how much easier it was and how much better I started to think, etc. But the big thing was when I was leaving, I thought, oh, well, I better turn on my email. As I was driving down the road, of course, you know, I'm getting hundreds of emails. So I had, I think it was about 1,800 emails that had come in during the week that I was away.
Wow.
And, you know, when I went to a coffee shop, opened up my laptop and just sat down and responded. It took me an hour and a half to respond to the ones that really needed. Most of them were crap. Didn't need to be responded. They were junk or whatever. But I realized, well, I did all of my emailing in an hour and a half for a week. Yet if I'm at home and in my office, not on the road, I tend to spend hours all day long.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and I thought, isn't that interesting? When I do it in that condensed one, it's a week, hour and a half, yet I can spend 3, 4, 5 hours a day, sometimes more, doing this kind of crazy emails. You know, wow, interesting.
Yeah. Oh, mate, that is so cool. 1,800 and you've managed to get back to the important ones in an hour and a half is fantastic. What a lesson.
Very, very eye-opening for me, and kind of put stuff into perspective about, A, just how much crap we get in our email, but B, just, if you're really focusing to get through them, it's a daunting task to look at an inbox with that many, emails to be responded to. But then, of course, you realize that 90% of them don't need to be responded to. And then the ones that do are really, very, very short. Bang, yep, got it, thanks, yep. Whereas I would normally probably spend more time on them. So interesting little thoughts there, I guess.
Yeah, and one of the things that I certainly do in my practice, and I certainly when I'm working with my clients, one of the things that I suggest, and just in terms of making that really practical on a day-to-day basis for dentists, one of the things that I've done in our practice is I've allowed about half an hour a day within my workday to have as administrative time. And during that half hour, so I'm time partitioning basically. I'm basically saying this is when I'm batching my email, this is when I'm batching my phone calls, this is when I'm batching writing referral letters or whatever it is that I'm doing. So I allow half an hour a day within my workday to do that. And whenever I talk to dentists about that, the first thing that comes up is they go, but, that's lost productivity, Jesse. You're losing half an hour. How many dollars an hour? And that's going to add up to this much over the year. And the irony of that, Andrew, is it's actually the opposite. What I've observed is I am so much more focused, so much more productive in the times that I've got my fingers in someone's mouth that it actually boosts my productivity, and it means that I just clear out the mental clutter as much as the physical stuff as well, and it's great.
Oh, look, I agree completely. I think the concept of maybe peak performance means working for 18 hours a day and, charging through and doing all that stuff. I don't think that's peak performance. I think that's lunacy. And I've certainly done that. And I did that for years. Did I get any more done? No, I just got less productive. I got into a routine in my business where I work 7 days a week. And the way that it happened, Jess, was quite simply because I didn't get anything done during the week because I was, talking to people, meeting with people, blah, blah, blah. And I started working after hours to get the actual work done. Then I would start going, I'm going to come in on Saturday and get stuff done. And then because I was going in on Saturday, I was just fluffing around on Thursdays and Fridays. I was there, but I was totally non-productive. And then because I had so much work to do, then I had to come in on Sundays as well. And all of a sudden, I was in a seven-day-a-week cycle, really, because it was just unproductive in my rituals and my routines. And then I made the decision that I was going to not work weekends ever again. And it was a long story why that happened. And I said, I'm going to work Monday to Friday. If I've got to work 20 hours a day, I'll work 20 hours a day, but I'm going to work Monday to Friday. And it was interesting. Within 6 months, I'd halved the number of hours I worked and doubled my income. So, look at that as an illustration of productivity and just, again, being focused and all the rest of it. Bad habits sneak in like we are so easily. I think they're the little killers, like lying in bed at night looking at Facebook, rolling over at 6 o'clock in the morning and checking your Facebook feed or checking your email. Really, how many vital emails have come in between 10 o'clock last night and 6 o'clock in the morning? Pretty much guaranteed.
I've got someone trying to give me SEO at midnight. Surely that's vital. Don't you get those emails at midnight too?
I do. I get them all. And I look at it and kind of go, so we become like lab rats where we're just responding to bells and tingles and emails and how many shares and how many likes. And we're like Pavlov's dog. We've got to have the right rituals.
Yeah, but it's interestingly enough as well, Andrew, because you mentioned the bad habits. And one of the things I've observed in myself actually is some of my bad habits actually started with really good intention.
Because
I would do something that I was trying to help someone. And of course, not that you don't want to help people, but sometimes you get into the habit of doing these things, with the best intentions of helping someone else, but that becomes your new norm. And all of a sudden, you've just got to, as you said earlier, got to learn to say no.
One of the biggest things that I've observed with businesses over the years, and I certainly have probably been in this situation myself, and I see it with men predominantly, and men are running a business. They start working longer, longer hours, spending less time at home. Right about when they actually get financially successful is when their marriage breaks down.
Yeah.
And they turn around and kind of go, but I did all of this for us. And the partner goes, yeah, but I just wanted you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I haven't seen you for 10 years, you know, cats in the cradle kind of stuff. And the fellow goes, well, I've got the successful business and this money. Now I'm going to sell it to pay for a divorce and I'm on my own. And you kind of go, interesting lesson there. I think we've got to have our family, we've got to come along with us on the ride. And they've always got to be number one. You know, that whole thing, blokes go, men, the mentality's got to build this business for the future of the family. The family want you now. They don't want you in 20 years when the business is successful. They want you now. And I think successful, smart people figure that out pretty quickly.
Yeah, look, I've seen that a few times as well. And it's a tragedy when you see that happen because, you know, you have this dichotomy where you've got this, you know, seemingly business success and you know, professional success, but the personal life is a complete disaster. And really, I think if we go back to that definition of success, what success really means to each of us, I think if we're really honest with ourselves, every single one of us would say, you know, personal success is actually more important in many ways than the commercial elements as well. And why are we doing it?
It's just that when you know, tight money's tight or you're younger or whatever it is, that becomes the appealing thing because we assume that with money comes all the things that we think, you know, freedom and a Playboy mansion or a, whatever your view of the world is around, you know, money and freedom. But the reality is it's not like that. You know, it's as we get older and smarter, we kind of go, well, what really matters are the relationships we have with others, our health and our well-being, our ability to influence people in a positive way, make a planet better, leave a legacy. You know, those things happen. But I think we all have to come into that realization at our own pace. You know, me telling you to come into it isn't going to make you do it. It's just, you know, I didn't think like that when I was 18 or 25 or probably 30. You know, it's only when I got older, I got a bit smarter.
Mate, when I was 18, my definition of success was a fast car and a bird on my arm, really. And
absolutely.
And that's fine, you know, when you're 18, that's no problem at all. I think you're right, though, as you get older, the things that you want or the things that you realize are important to you, you know, you suddenly become more aware of that sort of stuff as you go through life, which thankfully is the gaining of wisdom, I hope.
And lifestyle does become more important. We want to have a lifestyle business. I live in Cairns because I like living in Cairns. And, you know, I can run my business from anywhere in the world, really, these days. And I choose to do it from Cairns at the moment, that's for sure, because I can have a good lifestyle in Cairns.
Yeah.
You know, you can put on a pair of shorts and a, you know, pair of thongs and walk down the road 100 metres and have a cup of coffee with a friend. You know, you can go fishing. You can do the things that you want to do here. It's a lot harder to do that stuff in a city. In the largest city anyway. And, you know, again, but I'm not judging one way or another. I think it's more about, well, what kind of lifestyle do you want? It's like saying, well, what does success mean to you? Is the same as the question, well, what do you want your life to look like? I think that's success, peak performance, and answering those questions all roll into one.
Absolutely. And I think, again, coming back to that point, you know, one of the purposes of creating the business in the first place is to have that lifestyle. And that lifestyle does, you know, as you say, whether you live in Sydney or whether you live in Cairns or whether you live in Canberra, in my case, you know, that's all part of the deal. And the purpose of it is to, you know, you only get one life, so you might as well enjoy it. And for me, having an enjoyable life, in the definition according to Jesse Green of success, is to enjoy my life in every possible way.
Absolutely. And look, I think people sometimes confuse that, though, and they kind of think, oh, so you're sitting around, you know, you want to pick fluff out of your belly button and and chant. But of course, the reality of it is that it's not like that in the slightest. The reality of it is that, look, I work hard. I don't have a lot of stress, but I have stress. You know, I have commitments. I have financial pressure. I've got, you know, those whatever, you know, all the things that everyone else has. And you look at all of that kind of stuff and you go, but the difference is you choose how much of all of that you have.
Absolutely.
You know, if life is too stressful, I'll change my life.
Yeah.
You know, I find that if I have no stress, I don't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get out of bed. You know, like, give me 100 things to do and I'll get them done. Give me 3 things to do and I'll get none of them done.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us are like that. So it's, again, it's this whole success thing is really learning to understand yourself better.
Yeah.
And I think if you can do that, you know, everything else kind of falls a bit into place.
Mate, that is absolutely wonderful advice. And I think that anyone listening to the, you know, conversation we're having today is going to go, wow, you know. And, you know, in terms of thinking about, you know, takeaways for the audience, Andrew, I guess one of the things that I'd be encouraging, and I'd be interested in your feedback, is to put some thought into it. You know, what is it that I want out of my life? What does success look like to me, and at least? And how can we then, you know, move forward with that?
Absolutely. I think you have to start there. That's got to be the beginning. And then you've got to turn around and say, well, okay, you know, so that's what I want. So the logical next step is say, well, how am I going to get it? You know, and the logical choice there is find someone who's already got exactly what you've got and learn from them.
Yeah.
You know, move your way through that particular process. But if you're not clear on what you want, you'll get what you think you want. And often that's not the same as what you actually do want. We've got to have that extraordinary clarity around it, and I don't think enough of us spend enough time getting really clear on that. What does success mean to me? What does success mean to you? And more than the Ferrari, and more than the, you know, whatever it might be. It's an interesting realization, and I think that those who are truly successful are those who are able to really be clear about that in their own mind.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely 100% correct, mate. Gold right there, ladies and gents, from Andrew Griffiths. That is just a nugget of solid gold. So if you can get that clarity, I think you're halfway there, probably more than halfway there, really.
I agree, mate.
Now, mate, before we wrap up for the afternoon, I wanted to ask you a quick question. Given that you're an author, and I think I might know the answer to this, but if you could only have one book on your bookcase, what would it be?
It would have to be Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
I thought it would.
It has to be is my book that I guess I read every year. I can't stop reading it now. I mean, look, my house looks like a Dimmicks store. You could easily put a Dimmicks freaking sign out the front. You know, I've got books everywhere. For those who don't know, I do teach people how to write books these days. So I've got hundreds of authors of mine that I've taught. I've got their books as well as my own unhealthy addiction to books. So my accountant just shakes his head every time he sees my credit card statements and how much I spend on books on a monthly basis, let alone a yearly basis. But I read a lot, and I have a voracious appetite for learning. And I think it's one of the greatest joys in life is to be able to read a book. And, you know, as an unexpected bonus, you look at what you get out of it. $25 for a book, you got to be kidding me. It's the best money on the best money spent on the face of the planet, a good book in my view.
Yeah, look, there are lots of great books. And speaking of your books, Andrew, you know, the 12 books, and I guess this is a bit like trying to name your favorite child. Of the 12 books that you've written, is there any one for you that stands out that you've enjoyed writing or has resonated?
I enjoyed writing The Me Myth, which is my first personal development book.
Yep.
And that came out around 2010.
Yep.
And that was an interesting book because, like a lot of people, I've had quite an unusual kind of a life, I guess. And for me, I didn't want to write an autobiography. Initially, the publisher, Simon & Schuster, wanted me to write an autobiography. And instead, I kind of said, no, look, I want to write a personal development book, but I'll share my stories and my realizations and my observations in there. And so that's how it evolved. So The Me Myth was probably the one that I enjoyed writing the most for many different reasons. In terms of my business books, I guess probably the one that I'm proudest of is the Big Book of Small Business. I know it's a bit of a cliche kind of title, but it's a big book, 350 pages, and it's just filled with what to me are my philosophies and strategies and ideas around building a successful business. And it was a bit of a culmination of a lot of my work, so I think that was a nice, really enjoyable to write that book and put it together. And of course, since that's come out, and even The Meme is now, as you mentioned, mate, I do these days. I write so many columns and things like that on a weekly basis. I haven't had a book out for a few years, so I've got to change that this year. So I've got a few books in the pipeline that will be making an appearance in 2016.
Well, mate, I'm looking forward to that because both of the books you've mentioned are on my bookcase, and I'm looking at them right now. They are just behind me on my bookcase. And I've read them both, so I can certainly commend them to the listeners. And, mate, just if people did want to get a copy of those books, where would be the best place? Booktopia, Dimmicks?
Booktopia, Amazon, wherever they are, Dimmicks, any of those places. If they haven't got them, they can get them in.
Yep.
Very, very easy from that point of view. So, yeah, so I think they're easy to find, mate. No worries about that.
Yeah, lovely. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope the audience has, you know, taken away lots of little notes from all the, you know, bits of info and gems you've been sharing. And I just wanted to, on behalf of all the listeners, say thanks for coming on the program. And
a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you mentioned earlier, Andrew, that generosity is one of the key key indicators for success, and certainly, mate, using that one metric alone, you're in a phenomenal success. So thank you so much, mate.
Thank you, Jess, and thank you to everyone listening in. Always a pleasure, mate.
Okay, cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/podcast. And to discover how you can go large with your practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.